Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and your ears are being massaged with the help of Phil Shelley's magnificent oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Sunday, thousands of us attempted to get to Arsenal, and some of us even got there despite Sasta's very best attempts to stop us. It was a game that saw us beaten, but we were far from outclassed, and we certainly were not outsung in our 2-0 defeat. Also this week, Albion's women's team made it 2 wins out of 2 after beating Durham 3-2 in Hope Howe's first game in charge, and the under-21s drew 2-2 at Oxford, but took the bonus points in the penalty shootout in the Chequered Trophy. Also, Pascal Gross has been nominated for the Premier League Player of the Month for September. No chance. Joining me today are, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome back, for the first time this season, Piers Benjamin. And also, we welcome back a man who was once told that he would never be able to play any sort of sport. So the fact that he went on to play professional cricket for Sussex is some sort of, well, a miracle. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Lewis Hatcher. Welcome to the show, Lou.
Thanks very much, Eddie.
Your story is it's amazing, really.
Yeah, it's a bit of a rare one. It's a bit of a rare one, yeah.
I mean, we're going to touch on the full story, but I mean, it's a tale of triumph over adversity, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little bit different. I don't know how much you want to go into it right now, but
it's entirely up to you, mate.
Well, we'll touch on that a little bit later on, but it's just briefly. I mean, you had a thing called Poland syndrome, which is basically that is something which a lot of Paralympic athletes have, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty rare. It's about 1 in 100,000. The pretty much basic story of it is that I played professional sport for professional cricket for 6 years, hiding this impairment or disability, as you were.
It's an impairment that you knew you had.
Yeah, had it from birth.
Just very quickly, before we talk about sort of, you know, how you got through it and how you carried on and how you hid it, what is Poland syndrome?
So it's like I said, it's a very rare condition, about 100,000, and it's not known how it occurs, but it manifests itself very differently. You might remember Jeremy Beadle, the who's been framed.
TV host.
He had it, and for him, it manifests itself where he had a small hand. My hands are fine, but for me, I'm missing my right pectoral muscle and the two ribs that are directly behind it. So, when a cricket ball is coming at you at 90 mile an hour and you've got no chest or rib cage to protect your lung, that can be a bit problematic. So, yeah, but we can get into.
We're going to get into that first. But welcome back, Piers. It's been a while.
Yeah, nice to be back. Is it the first time this season?
It is the first time this season, yeah.
You're now a Premier League podcaster, mate.
Premier League something.
Yes. Yeah.
But I mean, you're not a raw virgin, but of course, young Lewis Hatchett here is. So, as tradition, tell us about your album supporting history.
Yeah, it's my first time here, first time meeting you guys, and it's very nice to be here. But my history with Brighton is. Been a lifetime support, really, through family. My dad was a lifetime fan. My first real memory was the last memory at the Goldstone, running on as a 7-year-old, grabbing a bit of the turf and then taking it home and watching grown men ripping seats out of the stands. I thought, wow, this is football. What's going on here?
This is not what happens every week.
I think I'd learned that by then, this is not what happens every week. So, yeah, that was my first memory, and then spent a few years at the Sorry Days at Withdean, and support them through that on the
cold stands
with the anoraks that were underneath the seats.
You were in the south stand, weren't you? Whereabouts were you? In the middle, towards the end?
Yeah, pretty much in the middle. Yeah, I definitely remember sort of standing behind Mickey Adams and seeing him. So we were directly behind where the players were. Crispies was the bloke who everyone was singing out songs to in the south stand. Yeah, and he was the guy starting the song.
I haven't seen him for years.
He ended up over in
H Block at the far end. Remember, he always used to be not running battles, but you know, running arguments between the stewards and people. Was it in H Block or the one at the far end? Well, I thought Crispy's always entrenched himself over there.
Yeah, he's in H-Block, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, I have seen him recently. He actually works about 100 yards from where we are now.
Really?
I've also got a feeling I saw him coming onto the pitch when it was the Shoreham air disaster tribute. I'm pretty sure, because I think he works for the NHS. I think he's a nurse.
Yeah, he is.
Works in A&E.
He's in A&E, yeah.
He's a first responder, so he may have been there.
And I think he was one of those that came on with the Worthing United scarf onto the pitch. So I think, but having said that, that's the last time I saw him. Previous time to that, I think Well, I mean, there are many famous tales about Crispies, but I think probably the big one I remember is him climbing up the support in the away end at Roots Hall on the first day of the season. When back to Mickey Adams, when we're shouting out, "Bring on the champions!" Mickey Adams goes absolutely ballistic inside the dressing room, thinking, "Well, that's Southend's team talk sorted."
Of course,
but Crispies is climbing up the stand.
Well, I haven't seen him since the days of Wifteen. I want to see him again.
Bring not, back but Crispy. Not professionally, I hope.
No.
I
don't want to see him.
If you see him professionally, that means something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
So you've got a cricket ball into your ribs.
Yeah. Crispies, if you're out there, Lewis wants to give you a hug.
Yeah. Or give me a song. Yeah. Do what he did with the old days.
Crispies do the rap. That's what we want.
Absolutely.
But okay. We're going to move on to Arsenal in a second. But before we do that, we have the news today that Pascal Gross has been nominated for the Premier League Player of the Month, which is quite some accolade when you look at who else has been nominated with him.
Well, there is that, but I'm also thinking, has he actually been our best player so far? And actually, I'm going to throw this one to you, Piers. I mean, would you have actually said, you know, if you'd have chosen an Albion Player of the Month, would you have possibly nominated Pascal Gross?
Two goals and two or three assists, I would say so.
Yeah.
Both our wins have been, he's been integral.
So you think that probably the stats that Gross has come across, that he's produced, is kind of, you know, reason enough? Or do you think that his general all-round play is enough, earned him it?
I think his general all-round play's earned it. He started the season totally out of position from where he'd played last year and has found his feet. I think the West Brom game was indicative of that. Two goals, assist for the other one. And even, I wasn't at the Newcastle game, but was it not his corner or cross that got headed back in for?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
yeah.
For that, how Hemed got that finish, I don't know.
Mm.
I was stuck at Lviv Airport swearing at Lot at the time. So,
all right. Hang on, that's Ukraine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were you doing there? Basking.
Something like that. Right, recreating a historical move.
Okay,
somewhere.
A phoenix from the flames somewhere. Okay. Okay. But, what went on in Ukraine stays in Ukraine. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, but I mean, just to let you know who else has been nominated. So he's up against Sergio Aguero, Kevin De Bruyne, Harry Kane, Romelu Lukaku, Jermaine Lascelles, and Alvaro Morata.
Well, I think it's a shoe-in for Gross.
Is a tough gig.
But what have you made of Pascal Gross from what you've seen of him this year?
I just think he's been brilliant. Nice addition to the team. It's going to be so hard, isn't it, with the way the Premier League is to just... It's how long these guys can sustain it, how long they can play at this level, and keep the team together. Really, I think that's going to be the biggest challenge.
There's a bit of that, and it's also how they can pick themselves up from defeats. Because against the top six, if we sneak a result, great. But the rest of it is beating the teams around us, which I know is cliched.
Yeah.
But that division is split between the sort of 14 teams and then six. Or elsewhere.
Temperament of the fans is going to be huge as well. From a player's point of view, like going to the Emirates last week was amazing. The fact that you're coming off the pitch, you've lost 2-0, yes, to a good team. I mean, still defensively, they're quite weak, but you come off, you've lost 2-0, and your fans are cheering better than the home fans are. It's how long that will carry on. And that will affect you as a player, I have no doubt.
Okay, well, let's move on to last Sunday at the Emirates then. And there was three changes to the team with Izzy Brown coming in for the suspended Hemed, Gay Ten Bonk and Jose Escuerdo preferred to Marcus Suttner and Anthony Knockhart, who dropped to the bench. Also, Glenn Murray was available and was on the bench.
Yes.
We were quite surprised by this.
A little bit. Well, we certainly weren't surprised about Hemed being dropped because he had to be dropped. Mm-hmm. I mean, the great thing is that at least he's not going to be kicking his heels because he's playing for Israel during the international break.
He'll probably get injured tonight.
Probably
though,
will. So. They're playing Liechtenstein tonight, so yes. Yeah. Who knows what's going on? I think the Crystal Palace of international football.
In a game, they can't qualify, so we should have feigned injury and stayed here. But,
Didn't he do that before and he got turfed out?
No, he fell out with the manager, didn't he, and they banned him.
Right.
Publicly started slagging him off.
Yeah, it's not the great... I mean, you know, he's had a promotion this season, but, you know, 2017 is probably a little bit of a mixed bag for Hemed personally, isn't it?
There was a lot of hearsay about that, but, I mean, I don't... He protested innocence, basically.
Well, he would, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
As Mandy Rice Davis once famously said. As for Bong coming in for Suttner, I don't think anyone could actually ever accuse Suttner of pulling up any trees just yet, has he? I mean, it's just left-back is just, I said it last week, the poor relation of the entire team, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess he was brought in because he's got pace and they were worried about the pace in that Arsenal side. I thought for the first 10 minutes it looked like a car crash waiting to happen. Mm. He got better. The problem with the left-backs, we let the good one go, whether he wanted to stay or not. Mm. Pocagnoli is better than the two we've got at the moment. Certainly
really?
May prove us wrong.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. But so, I mean, do you not think he blotted his copybook with his performance against Villa then?
It wasn't ideal, but, you know, there were a few things flying around that day. I think Suttner will be fine long term. He's not got bags of pace, which is frustrating.
What he does have is quality on delivery on set pieces, but he's not getting a look in on those either at the moment.
Well, rightly so, because you've got Gross with two or three assists. Knockout, we know what he can do, mm-hmm. which actually on Sunday when he came on, it looked like the proverbial size 10 he'd needed.
Yes.
His time will come, I'm sure, certainly, with dead balls and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he's the kind of player who's probably better on the ball than off the ball. I mean, for the large parts of the Arsenal game, and certainly, obviously, all of the Manchester City game this season, we've probably been better off the ball than on the ball. We've defended, by and large, brilliantly, but as we've found out, it only takes either a mossy goalmouth scramble or a bit of genius to actually undo us.
Yeah, I thought the Arsenal game was encouraging because against Man City, we parked the bus, didn't really believe we should be there. There were points in the Arsenal game where we actually competed.
Bought cinema a couple of times.
March's one goes in, one all at half-time. Probably not fair, but could easily have been. Mm. And actually, once we went 2-0 down and he made the changes, Murray came on, gave us a proper focal point up front. Mm.
Yeah, I think Murray's a big one in the fact that he can he's strong enough to deal with Premier League defenders. You could see as soon as he came on, he was able to hold himself up. He was easy to.
I think he's also well versed in the dark arts of sort of being a nasty striker.
Yes,
yeah. You know.
And let's face it, let's say Arsenal's defence isn't exactly blessed with pace. I've seen Yogurt turn quicker than that, so therefore it's not such a major issue for Murray. If he's up against a fast defender, forget it.
But one thing we were saying during and after the game, Al, was that the whole team seemed to be not playing with the fear that they did against Man City.
They've come on leaps and bounds in those 6 weeks. I'm going to say it was playing with fear. They played with stage fright against City. It was all Danny Proper could do to actually kick the ball straight. There must have been.
Davey.
I keep calling him Danny, don't I? Yeah. I see his name's Danny.
If him and Holler, you're just merging.
Yeah, I'm merging them. Yeah.
One Dutch something or other.
One Dutch mess. Yeah, I do. Yes. All right. Okay. Davey's on the road again. Okay. But now Proper is actually the proper thing, yeah.
Well, you don't know. He trained 2 days with the squad before that Man City game. Some of the stuff that was being said was ridiculous.
There was just a couple of times he would just swing his leg, sort of hoping. It was really like Preston Park stuff at times.
Well, let's be honest. If Kyle and Sidwell had been properly fit, he wouldn't have played in that game. They'd have integrated him into the squad.
Absolutely.
But last year we had too many midfielders.
Now we've
loaned them all out, and the ones we've got have got injured.
Or broken, yeah. We're old and smelly and broken. So, yes, we have come on leaps and bounds from the Arsenal game. And I think, actually, probably of the 7 games we've had, the only time we've really properly underperformed or really not got the result that the performance dictated was probably the Bournemouth game. We really should have got something out of that. With the others, yes, we probably got something at Watford, maybe. But again, I kind of thinking that with Watford, it was so new. You think, finally, a relatively easy game. And again, yes, they played well, didn't finish. But there was still this, oh my God, we're in the Premier League. What happens now? Is the sky going to fall in if we score? Is you know, are the Ravens going to leave the tower? It was to actually...
No, that's too sinister, Alan.
It's a bit, yes. Yeah, we've been down that road before. Never mind that. You know, all right, Crystal Palace aren't actually they're not encumbered by such a problem about what happens when they score. But for us, there was almost like, you know, you had to get that thingy off your back, whatever it's called, the monkey off your back, and which we did against West Brom. We have bit by bit been improving and playing with a bit more confidence, knowing full well that actually we're not up against people who can run around at 60 miles an hour and play like everyone does on FIFA.
Now, there wasn't a very early warning in the game, which was Lacazette's shot, which thundered off the post. It took us a while to settle, and there was conceding cheap free kicks around the box a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of... I mean, it's a vast improvement from Lewis Dunk from when he played against Arsenal before.
OK, well, I've got to say...
Leaving what's-his-chops at Theo Walcott alone in the penalty area in the first minute. Dumb-ass thing to do.
Well, I've got a stat about Lewis Dunk here, which is... it's amazing, actually, when you think about...
Are you going to talk about the 18 games?
He's gone 18 games without a booking, including games against Sergio Aguero, Jamie Vardy and Alexis Sanchez.
All of whom probably, you know, had a good go at tearing him a new one.
He's just going to get so much smarter, isn't he, though, in the Premier League? He's just going to be one of those players that I think you'll see mid-season just understands it by then. Just really, really hold... Him and Duffy will just hold that defence together. If they learn and stay fit and stay on the pitch, it'll be a completely different setup.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he could well be this season's Michael Keane, essentially.
Oh, you mean we're going to sell him for £30 million at the end of the season?
More than likely. I mean, but you sort of say that flippantly, but if we stay up, there will be players like Duncan Gross, if they perform, that clubs will start harvesting off us. Mm. We know the Albion loves harvesting.
Yeah, well, they go to Chelsea and then loan them out back out to us. Actually, you know that stat you just said about not being booked for 18 games? Apparently his previous 18 games to that were 6 yellows and 1 red.
Well, I mean, he had his own slot on Football Crime Wave, I suspect.
Well, I mean, he has done tremendously well, and you said that, yeah, he may very well be sold at the end of the season, but we have got...
Let's not talk about that.
But, I mean, what I will talk about is we do have a production line of other centre-halves coming through as well. I mean, it's...
Dunk is a year's head and shoulder. I mean, not literally, because Duffy's 3 inches taller, but he is head and shoulders above everyone.
Yeah.
More the keen comment was he will be the one that comes to people's attention, whether he gets sold or not, plays for England, God knows at this stage.
We know he's good, but he won't come to everyone else's attention until such time as he plays well in the Premier League, and he played well against Arsenal. He was okay against... All right, he scored an own goal. For some reason, that seemed to have blotted his copybook. I still think he was excellent against Man City.
Okay, yeah. Well, you came out with another stat, Al. It was the biggest attendance we'll have actually played in front of.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that now.
There's apparently 60,000 inside the Emirates, Lewis.
Hell no.
No, I mean, where were you with that? Because you were having a prawn sandwich or two, weren't you?
So. Yeah, I managed to get myself into a nice little corporate area, and that was a very nice day.
Right.
But it was very close to the Albion
fans. How do you know?
Fans.
I mean, can you remember, you know? Or...
No, I do remember it. Oh, okay. There weren't too many alcoholic beverages being consumed on that day.
Well,
but,
you've got no place on the Albion Raw then, mate.
But no, I'll tell you what was interesting was when, because Albion fans pretty much kept that roof on, or took the roof off pretty much at the Emirates. Yeah. And the Arsenal fans, it was so pitiable, wasn't it? It's so bad. Like, it's so weird to see a team that only when they score suddenly start doing something. And then when we went 1-0 and then 2-0 down, the fans that were around us, who I couldn't even tell if they were Arsenal fans, but just looking over at Albion fans going, oh, isn't that nice that they're still cheering along? And you're like, yeah, that's what fans do.
That's
and
really,
especially when they're just coming in the Premier League.
That sounds so condescending, doesn't it, though?
Yeah. It's condescending to Arsenal fans. Great.
It does. But then you kind of think, this is Arsenal. Like, this should be one of the... It is one of the pinnacles, isn't it? And it's not like that. And they're moaning about their own players. And
we should be beating teams like Brighton 6-7-0.
Yeah.
Of course, they're
expecting a win as soon as they come up, and in no means to, obviously if Albion fans had seen a draw that day, like, it was a good result. But for the Arsenal fan, it's just
they're expecting just to be sit back and be entertained, and when they're not getting it, they'll start.
They'll just moan. Yeah, I think they're just waiting for a moan. They're waiting to get their... everything off on their chest.
They're waiting just for the Wenger kick off. I mean, seems to be the norm there.
When you sat there and you're watching the game, I mean, Arsenal were clearly better than us, and you always felt that they had another gear to go into if they needed. But we tested them and we created a lot of chances, and one of those fell to Sonny March when he hit the post.
I'm going to call you on this. I'm not sure they did have another gear to go to. I'm not so sure they did. I mean, possibly the Arsenal side of, you know, the best Arsenal side, that would have probably had 3 or 4 gears to go through. This lot looked a little bit, in terms of a supposed top six club, I thought they looked a little bit limited.
Yeah. But the Arsenal fan we know said they look a lot stronger and tougher this season than last. So
I think it's still
worrying.
Still stems from their defence, doesn't it?
Yes.
Like, you've got to have if your defence is crumbling, everyone else is going to be panicking a little bit more, I think. And then to have players like Giroud and Walcott coming on, it does show their strength there, but individuals. Again, you've got to collect as a team, and that's how you're going to win games comfortably.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect there's something slightly rotten there if you look at the players they offloaded on deadline day. I mean, Gibbs going, established England player, going to West Brom, and Oxlade-Chamberlain as well, and they haven't replaced them. So it was almost Wenger was trying to clear a few things out.
Mm. I think he had to get rid of some to get some money in. But I mean, there was
you don't do it on deadline day. Oh, no,
though. I don't think it was even that. I think it was he wanted rid. There are endemic problems in that club, and Wenger's probably part of it. But he's there for 2 years. But actually, who cares? We've got to play them one more time.
Yeah, and down at our place. We've got to play them at our place. Yeah. So, yes, in answer to your point, yes, it was an excellent free kick, excellent shot from Solly March, and therein lies the difference. Sometimes it's in the Premier League, you know, such is a coat of paint. You know, the difference between glory and failure. I mean, you know, like you said, Lacazette hit the post. If that had gone in, I think that we were talking, appropriate enough for our guest here, a cricket score. That's what we all feared. Because, you know, as long as the Albion could hold out for, well, I think it was, what, 38, 39 minutes before they eventually scored, something like that. It's respectable, at the very least. Once it's, you know, in the first 15 minutes, then they can not go through the gears, but they can play with a little more freedom. And because we will be a bit more panicky.
I think it was also, I mean, at 2-0, it then became, please don't concede anymore, because our goal difference is good at the moment. And it was suddenly a 4-0 puts us in with everyone else.
Yes. Which brings us nicely on to Matthew Ryan.
Yes.
Didn't have the most auspicious of starts, but listed under getting better.
Yeah, agree, yeah.
He's a good height for a wicketkeeper, isn't he?
He is so small, isn't he? I mean, when I'll tell you what did impress me. What did impress me was Tim Krul was out there with him, just as everyone, they're about to kick off, and Tim Krul's there still working with him. Right. So I think that's really nice to see. Like just from a team,
goalkeeper's union.
Yeah. He's not sitting on the bench going, oh, okay, let's hope he sort of lets a couple in and I'm in sort of thing. He's actually there working with him. Yeah. But then it also even showed when Tim Krul's there how small he is. Like, but it doesn't matter. Like he does a job.
Everyone's obsessing about the height. I think Lloris is only an inch taller.
Yeah.
Who's considered one of the sort of top three keepers in the world. Yeah. So maybe we're making too much of it because Stockdale was a couple of inches taller and looked like he filled the goal.
Mm. It's not so much he proved him. His shot stopping is absolutely fantastic.
Mm.
But he also was starting to come for crosses. Now that's when you want your height from a goalkeeper, really.
Well, the thing is, he'll come for the cross, you know, and he'll get it. You know, it's the decision making as to whether to come for it, and sometimes you just have to trust your defence, and that's where I think actually what is just as vital is the communication between your defence and your goalkeeper, and we saw the issues surrounding that certainly in David Stockdale, and don't get me wrong, David Stockdale ended up being a fantastic goalkeeper, but David Stockdale's first season, some of the communication between him and his back four at times was appalling, and we lost goals for it.
But Alan, also, how much was it Stockdale's first season, there was no pressure on his place.
There was that as well.
You had Ankergun and Brezovan still. Yeah. Was Brezovan still there? Ankergun certainly was.
First season.
And then Mindpower came in, and the next 2 years, Stockdale looked decent.
But I think the big thing is actually it was about Ben Roberts came in for that second season.
I'm sure the coaching as well. But at the beginning of the season, there was no pressure on Matt Ryan's place. He was signed and was going to play because Mindpower's a perennial sort of collecting splinters.
Quite like Mindpower, actually.
I would have had no problem with Nicky Mempar starting the season.
Would have, because if he wasn't good enough to upend, to remove Stockdale from the team, how is he suddenly good enough to play in the Premier League?
That's
sorry.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
As soon as Krul came in, Ryan's game picked up. There was suddenly proper pressure on that place.
I wouldn't get hung up on the size of him. Like, you have to judge a goalkeeper for being a goalkeeper. He will find a way, whether it be, OK, I'm a bit weak on the ball being crossed in and corners. Like, that's not my style of play. Like, is it how every sportsman will do whatever they do in whatever sport they do? They adapt to however they are. I think we have to judge him purely on his stats and how well he plays. And then to have someone, like I said, Tim Krul around him, helping him out. Mm. And if he's willing to do that, he's only going to get better.
Well,
I think,
what was
right.
clear a couple of times, certainly during the match, was Petr Cech, wasn't it? He would often throw himself into traffic, but then he's big enough he's huge enough to actually be able to do that. And some of his punching was absolutely superb. Mm. And it's not the sort of thing that necessarily, I mean, let's put it this way, if you're going to go in for a three-way sandwich between Duffy, Dunk and Ryan, because they're all going for the same ball, Ryan, being the smallest, should know to get the hell out of Dodge. You leave that to the two Colossuses, and let them sort of crash into each other, because that's when Tim Krul comes on if he tries to challenge
those
two.
And the more they play together, the more those guys, because those three are very important in the defence. But the more they play together, especially at that level, Premier League, they're just going to learn. Like, yes. You have to realise it is a learning experience for them all as well, because they've not played with each other like this.
When to come, when to not come, when to stay on your line, when to come and crash everything.
And they're going to learn, and potentially from mistakes, I think. There will be mistakes along the way. It's obviously their job to...
Well, the biggest mistake that Ryan has made so far, I think, is probably the Atletico Madrid game, where he let a shot go straight through his legs.
Was it one where he threw it in the net, or was that the Madrid game?
That was Madrid, yeah.
I was in the bar at that point.
There's a couple of other unconvincing moments. The jury was out. They're starting to return their verdict.
There was always going to be a jury out on him, because a fan's favourite went under a bit of a cloud and a weird move. So you were all... If Ryan starts badly, your internet idiots are going, well, we shouldn't have let Stockdale go. Well, Stockdale wanted more money, didn't want to fight for his place, whatever it was. He's gone. Ryan is the incumbent. People should have got behind him to start with.
Absolutely.
Sure. Okay. Just before we move on, a quick word on Jose Escuero's performance.
A bit something and nothing, I felt, I'm afraid to say. Brilliant shot that went out for a throw-in.
I turned to my brother, I go, it's going for a throw, and he went, nah, not. It's gone for a
throw. Sorry, actually, you say before we move on, I mean, Lou was talking about, obviously, you know, the library existence that he had up at the Emirates when he was there. We haven't talked to the fellow who was actually in the middle of the noise-making stuff. So, I mean, I've got to ask you, Piers, what for you was it like? I mean, could you tell that there was actually, you're... Well, outdoing everyone, especially when you couldn't hear anything else.
It was very obvious they were not getting behind their team, shall we say. I mean, we ended up with about 10 idiots to our right trying to goad it. And it was sort of, well, guys, you've not got behind your team. You don't really have the right now to question Little Brighton. And, you know, you've had your fun, now go home. I mean, Arsenal have always had a reputation for being a quiet club. But I suspect...
I've been to Highbury a couple of times to watch them,
Highbury was known as a library as well. I mean, compared with Spurs, Chelsea, West Ham. But it'll be interesting, certainly going to West Ham and Spurs, where they're in massive stadiums. West Ham, you're miles from the pitch. Tottenham aren't very comfortable at Wembley. What the atmosphere's like at those?
Mm. Well, yeah. Well, us going to West Ham, it's going to be like a bigger version of With Dean for us, really, isn't it?
No, I can't say we
paid for With Dean. The taxpayer didn't pay for
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yeah.
Good point. Well made.
Well, the other thing I'd say is that we were in the press area, so we were kind of on the opposite side of the pitch, right at the sort of the back of the very lowest tier. So, yeah, it was fairly low down. I think probably not a dissimilar thing to the height of where you have the press area, the lower press area at the stadium, albeit that's on the halfway line. And of course, you know, the Brighton fans were in the opposite corner. And there were a couple of times where we actually, you know, we were talking to each other, me and Adi were talking to each other, and we actually had to stop because the Brighton fans were singing. And dear God, that racket really did. Just the 3,000 out of a place. I mean, if that place was really rocking, 60,000 people, that would be seriously loud. But it just isn't. But having said that, Brighton fans, with their 3,000, which is what, one in every 20 people, could really make the place sing, really make the place, you know.
It's a nice stadium, isn't it? Like,
it's a lovely stadium.
It's phenomenal.
The infrastructure, the footprint of the whole place and everything, you know, all the lovely sort of like touches that they have. And yes, they're big on their history. Good for them. They've got a good history to celebrate.
But 75 minutes. That's what time it started emptying out. I mean, it was always quite empty.
We can't go down that road.
Yeah, we really can't. No,
at least we wait for the 82nd minute.
No, I'm not going to actually. I know you made a big thing of saying this. We're not going that way.
Okay. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We're brought to you in association with OldFootballShirts.com, and I have a minger. The shirt of the week. I'm just going to pass this over to young Lewis over. If you can just describe what this is for us.
Oh my God.
Without swearing.
What colour is that? Is that yellow?
Is that blood down there?
That looks like... Yeah.
Okay, what we're looking at here is a kind of... It's like those 80s sort of two-tone stripe. So it's a yellow smooth with yellow...
It's not two-tone. That's too
what do you call it? Two fabrics.
Two fabrics.
Two fabrics.
It's shiny.
Yeah, it's the nipple burning stuff.
It looks like an Oxford shirt.
So it's yellow with either black or blue cuffs and collars.
That is covering something up because they don't want to be. No, Lorenz. Whoever was behind that doesn't want to be associated anymore with this strip. So we'll cover that up with a. They look got a dine bad.
Dine bad.
Is it German or Austrian?
Bad is. I think bad is German for lower in this instance, isn't it? So. Is there a club called Lower Dean or something like that?
No, there isn't.
Okay. Is it German?
No, it's
not. Is it Austrian?
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's Austrian. It's... And is it going to be some obscure 5th Division club that plays at the equivalent of Preston Park?
Possibly.
Is it the original Salzburg team before Red Bull got involved?
No, it's not.
Okay, tell us what Phil's given us this week, this minging thing that Phil's given us.
Here you go then. This is the 1986 to 1987 home shirt of Austrian side 1st Vienna. This is, in fact, a match-worn shirt of the Argentinian legend Mario Kempes, who played for Vienna for just one season. A bit of history of the shirt colours, well done for that, Phil, of 1st Vienna. In the late 19th century, Austrian banker Anselm Salomon von Rothschild got fed up with his Scottish gardeners rampaging around his grounds playing football and causing damage to the flower beds and shrubs. To avoid further disruption, Rothschild gave them a pasture nearby to play in and a set of former jockeys' jerseys in the blue and yellow colour of the riding stable. The team of gardeners later became 1st Vienna FC. So there you go.
Blimey,
should
Phil.
Have said gardeners.
It is, yeah. Scottish gardeners, yeah. Is that? He usually gives us a nickname. Is there not a nickname this time?
No, that's what we've given
right, Scottish gardeners it is, and that's not a euphemism either.
But Mario Kempes.
Mario,
I'm surprised he was still playing in 1987, actually.
But the thing is, when I see that, you know, the nature of the fabric there, all I see of if there's obviously it's just a shirt, there's no head coming out of it, but if that there was a head, it would be mulleted, that sort of style. And like I say, there's
especially in Austria.
Well, yes, I suppose this actually, yeah, I mean, that could be from 2012 and it'd still be mulleted.
With a nice denim waistcoat or something, that's a moustache.
La 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 la,
opus. Marvellous.
Yes.
Marvellous. Okay, just before we move on to your story, Lou, this week out you were at the Amex and there was a forum.
It was Kick It Out forum, yes it was. I wasn't sure if it was something that Kick It Out themselves were actually on doing a tour of, but there was a fair few people who came down from Spurs, Proud Lily Whites and Gay Gooners, and a few people representing Lewis, and someone came down from Proud Canaries, Norwich fans. Kick It Out. People, I think, associate Kick It Out with being basically anti-racist, but it's not. When it was set up in 1993, it was anti all forms of discrimination. It's just, I think that at the time, racism was the big sort of thing. I mean, it wasn't homophobia itself. Yes, there was homophobic elements, but because it wasn't a consideration across the national sort of agenda, it wasn't such a big thing. It is now, and it's, you know, because largely, I think we can all agree that largely, certainly overt racism has largely gone from English football, from British football. But homophobia, as we all know as Brighton fans, is still there. So we had it was just a panel. It was hosted by Paul Mortimer, who used to play for Charlton, who's now part of Kick It Out. There was Hope Powell, Brighton women's football team manager. There was, next to her, was Sophie Cook, transgender, former photographer at AFC Bournemouth. There was Anwar Uddin, who is a British Bangladeshi footballer, Liam Rossignol, and Chris, and I cannot remember her name, it just sounds mildly Greek, and that sounds offensive in his own right, who's a member of Proud Lily Whites. And they were just sort of generally... it was kind of appealing to a home audience. The people that turned up, there was about 40 or 50 people there, appealing to a home audience of just what it takes to be or to tackle racism and homophobia and even things on religious grounds within football. I mean, you know, obviously within Brighton and Hove Albion, we've got, you know, shock horror, the Daily Mail will be appalled, we've got a Jew playing alongside an Arab.
And their best mates.
And for us, it's not a story. And in fact, for the rest of the world, it's not a story. But for some people, it's an issue. The ongoing issue of there never being a men's professional footballer who's come out as gay. Not an issue with the women's game, but in the men's game, it's, you know, football is still so far behind the curve.
But is that just football or is that men's sport?
Well, in cricket,
there's one I can think of is Stephen Davis.
Steve Davis, yeah. Well, funny enough, I'm actually very good friends with one of the first ever professional cricketers to come out gay. His name's Alan Hansford. He played for Sussex for a few years, actually, in the past. And he's a good friend of mine. And yeah, I mean, he hid it for quite a while, actually. He, I think he actually came out after he'd finished playing. Steve Davis was probably the first player to...
He was whilst playing.
And yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Cricket's a very interesting sport to come from a discrimination point of view, because we are so diverse. I've played with people from all around the world, from many different cultures. I've roomed with people who are Muslims, and they will be, you room with them and they're up at 5 a.m. praying, and that's just, you just got on with it. You completely understood that's what they believe in, and there was no, you're a teammate, you're a friend. And I think it really opened my eyes to the world of how people are and how different people are, and just you accept it massively.
But
I think,
is that also, getting to demographics, but cricketers tend to be better educated than footballers.
This was going to be my next point in the fact that I go to a football match, and even when I was at the Emirates, there were things that I really didn't like. And some were coming from Brighton fans, and some were coming from Arsenal fans. And I think that this is just... it's a miseducation, a lack of education from a lot of people, and lack of understanding. And sometimes it can be because they're in big crowds, and people
emboldened by that.
Emboldened by one idiot saying something, and then people going, "Well, I'm not brave enough to go. That's wrong. I'll just go along with it." Or, and then you've got kids there, and then you're starting to bring up the next generation, and that's where it starts to snowball. And you look at it and go, well, you go to Twickenham and it's a completely different atmosphere. And you go to Lords, or you go to the Oval, or you go to any cricket ground or anywhere in the world.
Have you been to Old Trafford for a test match?
Anyway, but headedly Old Trafford.
I mean, how much of that is about segregation, though? Because obviously in rugby and cricket, everyone mixes all together, and you don't necessarily have that tribal element.
I think Pierce's point's so relevant, the fact that it's the origination of where the sports came from and the classes of which they came from. That has just stemmed down massively. I mean, but by no means are those sports now only for upper class. I mean, I came from a state school. A lot of guys I grew up with playing cricket with came from private schools. But there, you see now more participation being done at the lower end and state schools, and for both rugby, for every sport. But obviously, football being our biggest sport in the country, and it's so globally, it's the biggest sport. So it's tough, because it applies to absolutely everyone, and that's when you're bringing in other ideas, other people's views. And
is it players not coming out because they're worried about their teammates, or worried about the tribal element in the crowd? In reality,
are we talking about cricket here?
We're talking about football here, because I'm sure within that Surrey dressing room there was no problem with Steve Davis. It was just, a lot of them knew it anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, and from listening to guys that played with him before he came out, I think guys knew. Like, they definitely knew. So I think in house, I think a lot of guys will know, and football's even more wrapped up, in the sense that to get a story coming out about something like that will take a while, because either guys don't talk about it, footballers are harder to get to than other sportsmen, like they're so well media trained that they can sort of dodge bullets very easily. But I think, yeah, it's
can you get your head around why football is so behind the curve on this?
It's such a broad conversation there, yeah. But I mean, again, it fundamentally comes from the people that are watching the sport, and it's not the guys on the field. It's not there. It's nothing to do with them. It's the view from other people. And you know what? The years I was playing at Sussex, you realise how little fans know. You really do realise that. Like, I mean, we can sit here and talk about Brighton, but we may could be completely wrong. It is merely our opinions of what we view, and that was fundamentally what I saw when I was playing at Sussex. We would be saying one thing, and we knew one thing, because that's maybe where our goal was heading and where the team was heading. But the fans are saying something completely different. So Sussex's season this year, they didn't win anything, but they'll be thinking completely differently. They'll be thinking maybe 2-3 years down the line for where they've got sustained success. And these are the things that happen in house that you will never really fully know unless you're there. And that's I mean, that's the brilliant thing about sport. That's why people can always have an opinion and people can always talk about things. But fundamentally, they could be completely wrong.
But is the culture within cricket anyway? And we're getting back to the kick it out thing from last night. But is there any culture within cricket, either within the players or the administrators or the fans that you get to speak to, that has these issues that football has, i.e., well, the racism is largely gone, but I don't know if it's still there within the cricket administrators. I mean, you consider these sort of these knackered old farts from Sir Buston Tufton up at Lord's, who, you know, was still a throwback to the old colonial days.
It's run by Grocer now.
But do you feel that you know that cricket has got its house in order, or do you think it still has its issues?
It has had its issues. I mean, I've played in games where there's been racial slurs used, but what happens is it gets dealt with there and then. The officials, this is another big point, is the officials in the game manage it brilliantly. Both in rugby and cricket, the officials have got it. I mean, this year that you're going to see, I think it was the 28th of September, they brought out new rules in cricket where...
the false fielding thing.
Yeah, well, they've got yellow red card sort of thing. There's going to be like sin bins in cricket. So the umpires are getting more and more... There's a very fine line. There is a very, very fine line, but they're getting more and more power to do things. But you look at refs and I think refs have actually got a big role in cleaning up the sport. I think they've got one of the biggest, actually.
Do you think, though, but I mean, because in football, I mean, there's the respect issue with the referees, because in cricket and rugby, for instance, rugby, they all call the referee sir.
Can't. It's got so bad in cricket even that you can't even sort of huff and puff in the fact that you're annoyed at yourself for getting out, because it could be interpreted as you're having a go.
You say that, Lewis, but Anderson with Erasmus the other day was lucky not to be taken out of the game.
100%.
Because he was given, and he walked away still mouthing off.
You also have to, there's another element to it that you have to realise, that players have relationships with the officials as well. Yeah. And there'll be no doubt that there'll be players who have relationships with officials in football. I mean, Mark Clattenburg, he's going to have, from a lot of things I hear, he's got a very big ego himself, and he's going to have these relationships with footballers. And when you're that high up in the sport, it's... You're seen differently than just an official. You're almost like a little celebrity. Yeah, and one of them. Yeah,
But I think that's unhealthy when you're playing. You know, when they're playing. You know, they're officiating a lower level game. Like, for instance, the equivalent, I guess, would be a first class umpire who's actually then officiating a club game.
But that happens. Yeah,
but I mean, do you get that same sort of level of palliness that isn't there, and then they get a different sort of attitude to officiating a game?
I think no, because sometimes they're even there. Well, it's tough because you've got two officials on the pitches. Once they're there to potentially work with the other one, but a referee on his own, you need strong characters. I would look, the biggest, best example I can think of, a single ref on a field, Nigel Owens. It's so well documented how he gets respect from players in rugby. You need a referee, you need the FA, you need FIFA, someone to go, this is where we're going to go with officiating games, because we see them as the guys who pretty much, they are the rules of the game, and therefore that can only flow back down.
But I mean, you're right. But then, if the referee does the letter of the law in football, and the player's gobbing off, and he books him or sends him off, then he gets accused of sort of ruining the flow of the game for enforcing the rules.
But then you go back. The ref is doing his job, and then it's the player's job to follow the rules, and you can't sit there and go, oh, he sent off five people in a game. Why did he do that? Well, they all broke the rules. No, I can't really disagree with that.
Neil Warnock tried to do that. but you're right. And is it also, certainly within rugby and cricket to an extent, the captain is the one that deals with the officials? Should you have something similar in football at that point?
Well, technically, you're meant to be.
It's supposed to be
You should be, but I see the captain armband as just like a... in football, just as a token thing.
Decoration.
It's very much token.
We'll
you're not going to know, unless you're in a changing room, of how much voice that captain has, how much say that captain has on where the team goes. In other sports, it's very well known that the captain of my team picked the side. Even the coach didn't pick the side. The captain picked the team. And that pretty much goes throughout most of the sport.
Is that
the
club
teams.
Cricket or county?
County.
Mike Yardie was picking a lot of those teams.
He would pick the team on... there's obviously a conversation that goes on with the vice and the coach. At the end of the day, if Mike wants you in the team, or Ed or Luke wanted you in the team, they were the guys that made the decision. And I don't see that in football. That's what the manager's job is. And hence why he's called a manager rather than the coach, because there is a coach that's underneath him. So... it is so different, but I really hope football does clean itself up.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's leave that one there, because we've got to talk about how you came to be in professional sport. And it's quite some story. So, I mean, what age did you first know? I mean, I know you were born with a condition, but what age did you first realise there was something different?
I wasn't really... I have a younger brother, Brad, you know him as well, and... Brad's only a year younger than me, so we're very, very close, and we competed very closely throughout, still do. And
I know.
Yeah, and
some even say he's a better cricketer than you.
Yeah, he probably is.
Now.
I wasn't treated any differently because Bradley's fully able-bodied, and we just got on with things. But there would be the occasion, as I'm going to school, like Lewis, mum and dad would say, Lewis, just remember you can't play rugby, like, just remember you... You're not going to be able to do contact sports, and just be careful sometimes. But very rarely would they say that. So I knew the boundaries of what I could and couldn't do, but I still threw myself into everything, growing up, playing every sport I could, and then eventually finding a real passion for cricket, going to the county ground, seeing guys playing there, running on the pitch after, getting autographs.
So who are your fastest heroes then?
Funny enough, Jason Lurie was my biggest hero, left arm swing bowler. And that's why I took the number five shirt.
Yeah, well, you've modelled your hairstyle on him
and
as well.
Yeah, and everyone was like, oh, you
from
do
the same
like
neck of the woods as well, aren't
you? Yeah, I did say I was better looking, but we'll take that. Yeah. But Jason was probably one. But I really learnt a lot of cricket in the Caribbean. We have friends in Barbados, and we managed to go out and holiday there a few times. And I grew up watching people like Courtney Walsh, Curtly Ambrose, and these guys. I used to have as much West Indies kit as I did England kit, and I would watch those guys bowl and watching them live. And that was really when I started to massively think, right, this is something I'd love to do. I'd love to be a professional cricketer. But at the time, my condition really wasn't what I was thinking about. I was just thinking of a sport. I was young and I was keen, and that was it.
Because you were playing a lot of cricket, and became a passion with you and your granddad as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, he actually just introduced us to how to do it in the garden. And then from there, Brad and I would grab a bat and a ball. We'd tear up Dad's precious lawn and... from dusk till dawn, and that was it, really. And then sort of have lunch in between. When CFAX was on, we'd check the Sussex scores so that we had the team sheets, and then we would take the team sheets and we'd pretend we were in the teams. Like, in comes to bat is Marcus Trescothick, and I'm Jason Lurie, James Kirtley, and I'm bowling at Brad. And
hang on, so if you're Jason, does that mean basically you spent your childhood trying to knock Brad's head off?
Yeah, so I mean, that was the thing. Like, he even says now, he's like, people forget how hard it was for me to knock Lou all around the garden with bat and ball, and he would bat way more than I would, because as soon as I bat, I just want to bowl again. So I would, I'd just be wanting to do that and hit my little brother in the head with a ball and something like that.
Okay, but I mean,
beamers.
Yeah.
I've got to sort of ask this again, because we sort of briefly touched on it at the top of the show. The condition that you have, I mean, which obviously is from birth, as you've grown into a full size adult, what has it meant physically for you? What are you deficient in?
Right. So, missing my right pectoral muscle, it's your big chest muscle that you sort of push with.
Your tits?
Massively, yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm missing my right tit. And that's not there. But right behind where that is... There's two ribs that are missing. Now, that, first of all, means that I'm very vulnerable. There's pretty much just skin and lung on my right side. But where that muscle was missing, other muscles had to compensate in order to do certain movements. And especially for me, I'm being left-handed and this affecting my right side... Having your front arm up, which would be my right arm, is quite tough for me. Like, getting my right arm above my head was really hard.
And there's no muscle to put it
up. There's no real muscle to support it and get it up there. So I had muscles that grew sort of twice the size on my right side compared to my left. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that was those muscles were being so overused. They sort of pull my scapula out of place. They're really tight.
Your
shoulder blades out of place. And I would get headaches daily, really, and it would... If I'm doing something for a long... And this still happens now. If I'm doing something all day for a long time, then it will really start to burn, and then you get these headaches. But I took up... Three years ago, I decided to take up yoga, and it massively helped. So just really lengthening out the muscles and actually calming them down. And also doing some very monotonous, tedious strengthening exercises that don't look like much, but for me, they do a lot. And yeah, so those are kind of the physical sides of that I'd have to deal with from a young age to now. But from a young age, I really didn't take notice of it because I was just so keen on sort of trying to do stuff.
Did you find you had to change your bowling action though?
Yeah,
compared to everyone else's.
Technique was something I had to really work on. So, like I said, I couldn't get my front arm up. So, I had to figure out a way to keep it up there longer because not getting too technical in cricket, your front arm as a bowler is really, it's like your rudder basically, and it steers you in the right direction. And if it drops too early, it means you can start spraying the ball everywhere and you're not accurate enough. So, I had to find a way to get that to be accurate. So, I've decided one day, I literally remember the training session where I was like, it's really hurting, I couldn't do it. And I thought, well, if I actually pull my left shoulder back, my right shoulder just goes forward. So I thought, all right, I'll just do that. And just kept pulling my left shoulder back. Eventually sort of taught myself muscle memory how to just do that. And
was
and
this
found
by the
my
time you were at Sussex?
Yeah, so I was a junior that was trying to get into the Sussex side. I was going through trials. I did it a really different way getting into the Sussex team. I wasn't very good.
Blackmail.
a few 50s from dad. But I wasn't very good. I was about 14 when I really decided I wanted to be a professional. And I thought, right, what have I got to do? I want to get onto the Sussex age group. That's what I want to do. I want to get on their age group stuff. So there were trials coming up. And I went to the trials and I knew I wasn't very good. Like, these guys were coming from private schools with fresh kit and looking amazing. And I was coming from this state school. Never no cricket at school. Always had to get it outside of school at my club, St. James. And then went to these trials and saw these guys were better than me and just had to try and stand out. My dad just went, just go and ask loads of questions. Ask them, be in their face. Just show a great attitude. That's what you can do. If you're not as good, just show them a good attitude. Managed to get myself on the under-15 team. So that season went a lot. This whole season, there'd be about 10 games and they used to send the team sheets in the mail. Yeah. So they'd come and I'm really excited. This team sheet's coming. And this team sheet would come and I'm carrying the drinks. I'm like 15th man, not even on the 11th.
So did you have to struggle to carry the drinks?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, over the shoulder.
Over the head.
Yeah. Come here, garçon. I went for that whole year and I wasn't really getting seen. And I thought, I need to stand out again because otherwise I'm just going to get dropped. I'm going to be left in the lurch. So my dad said, just call up the head coach of the Sussex team, Mark Robinson. Just call him up. Here's his number. I was like, what? Like, no one does that. I'm 15 years old. Like, why? And he said, yeah, just go ask. Just go up. That was pretty much me. Like, go and ask him if you can go and train with the professionals. Oh, what? Really? So I rung him up. And, of course, Mark would say, who is this? No, you can't. Put the phone down to find out the training next week. I'll ring him again. And did it for week on week. I couldn't put a number on it, but put it week on week. And
so
then eventually,
he just gave up, basically, didn't he? He just gave up.
Yeah, basically, I think someone got
you
ill.
Do this again,
whatever.
Mate, I'm having you arrested.
Yeah, whatever it is.
It's known as stalking.
Yeah. Whatever it was, someone got ill, someone got injured, and they let me come and just train with them and just bowl. And you're literally a bowling machine for a day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought, I'm at least here, I'm learning off these guys. And eventually, I did that so long that I actually got a stress fracture. I got injured. I was doing it too much. I was 15.
Well, they're knocking
16.
You about all over the place.
Yeah,
as well.
It was demoralising.
But at the same time, you're doing this. Obviously, you've still got the conditions. Yeah. I mean, what did the professionals make of and the coaches and the medical team?
Didn't know.
You managed to actually hide it from them.
I kept a shirt on. You keep a shirt on. You don't tell them. I went the other way, especially when I was batting. Batting was the tougher part, really, because I became very vulnerable. And just getting a chest guard off the shelf is not sufficient enough to stop a bullet-like ball coming and hitting your lung. But I thought, right, okay, I'm not going to shy away. In no way am I going to, if they go, right, we're doing bouncer practice and everything's going to be up at your chest and your face, in no way am I going to back down and say, I can't do this because of this condition. I chose to actually say, I'm in. Like, I'll be the first one in.
But Lewis, as long as you've got bat on ball, you were doing better than Mark Robinson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I decided to make a move and go the brave end. And like, if I show I'm ultra brave, then they can't really knock me for it. And
it's could have killed you.
When I got injured, that's when I learned I needed to really work hard on my body to be there. And I made a decision then that if I'm going to become a pro, I can't let my body be a reason for them to not pick me. I can actually deal with them not picking me as a cricketer for my skill level. But if they go, your body's not good enough, you can't come in. So I decided to make myself the fittest player in the team. I looked for the fittest player on their test scores as a pro and tried to match it. And that's literally how I committed myself to physically getting into the sport. And And after a couple of trips to Australia, asked the coaches what I needed to do. I was carrying drinks for a couple of years in the second team. I just managed to keep myself around enough for them to know who I was. Again, there were guys that were way above me who they were putting a lot more investment in. And I decided to go to Australia, have a couple of trips out there. And they decided that I was starting to improve. I was starting to show some promise. There was a moment where I got to, I came back from Australia and I saw these guys that were ahead of me and I said, right, these guys are clearly ahead of me, but I want to be this opening bowler for the second team. Sat down with the head coaches and academy directors and said, right, I either want to do this or I need to go somewhere else. So I said, give me 1 month, let me be the opening bowler for a month and let me see how I go. So I went, okay, cool.
Right, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll edit this bit out because we've only got 2 minutes to go and we've clearly got a lot more story to go here. So what we'll do is we'll carry on. We'll finish on 57 minutes or 58 now. So Lewis can carry on with the story and we'll have a little bit of an extra podcast thing afterwards. Okay, so you had... How many years was it in between breaking into the first team and actually them saying, hang on a minute, Sunshine, you're not quite... fully formed, we need to have a word with you. I mean, how long did you manage to hide it before they said, this isn't good?
No, there was never that point, actually. Like I said, I managed to get myself in... I'd got myself to the point where I was playing around second team cricket. I was that opening bowler. I did well for a little bit.
Your figures were backing you up as well.
Yeah, massively. So I let my cricket do the talking, really.
Division season, wasn't it? Was it a Middlesex?
So that was 2010, yeah. Yeah.
Southgate, was it?
Yes, Uxbridge.
Uxbridge.
At Uxbridge, yeah. And they put me in the first team squad. I managed to get into the team. But all the way, to answer your question, really, like to the whole time they had... the whole time they'd seen it. The coaches knew. There were times where I was on the physio bed and I'm obviously had my shirt off and they knew about it, but no one really say anything. Like they couldn't touch me in a way. Like literally, like my cricket was doing the talking.
When they did actually sort of find out what it was that was the issue, what was that actually said that got them to say, you can't be doing this anymore?
It was more surgeons, really. Like when I had that first injury, they were like, this is your condition is not helping you. This is going to keep happening, and really at no point did the coaches ever bring it up. Like I wouldn't allow them. Like I become very defensive about it. If anyone ever mentioned it or made it belittled it, I fought back.
Accused of discrimination. Almost.
Well, no, I didn't. I just fought back. I went, no, I'm going to show you, and I would do the job. Like I said, There was no point in my career where I allowed anyone to say I was pulling back off the throttle. I was not throwing myself in. I made myself not... I went in night watchman every game that I pretty much played. Nothing to do with our batting lineup and how we were playing.
No.
But I was the one, and that's a tough job. It's actually an annoying job to do. Like you're either getting it at your face or at your toes, and it's a sort of thankless task, really. Mm-hmm. If you get out, you're a tail ender, but if you hold in there and take a few blows, like... that's what we do. And I thought, right, I can do that job. Like,
do you think it was a bit of a bravado when you're looking back? Do you think it was a bit of a bravado on your thing? Or
Massively, but it helped me.
Because, I mean, at which point then, because you had some specialist equipment made for you.
Yes.
So, and you had a Kevlar vest, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Kevlar,
my second year. So like I was saying, the chest guards off the shelf weren't doing cutting the mustard. So my second year as a pro, I thought, I remember watching Sean Tate bowl and I went, oh my God, if I'm going to face Sean Tate, like, Lou, sort yourself out here. And luckily, Mark Davis, who's the head coach now, his wife is a physio and it was someone at Royal County Hospital, actually.
Okay.
That I met here who does the casts for broken legs and broken arms and came up to see him and he had some links with the military and he did a cast to my chest and he went, I'm going to go get something made, be made out of Kevlar, be bulletproof. Came back, we designed it. It was fully moulded to my body.
Lightweight?
It's lightweight enough, yeah. It's really comfortable, really. And that was it. They gave it to me and it's one of a kind. No one else has got one. And it's my chest guard that I bat with and it completely changed my game because obviously it gave me the confidence that if I was going to get hit, I wasn't going to get hurt. So
bear in mind that you're a cricketer and this thing is pretty much made of metal. Is it waterproof?
It's not sweat-proof.
and heat-proof, because, I mean, obviously you're playing in all weathers.
Yeah, really. Well, when I played in Australia, it was really hard. Like, that was really tough, because 45 degrees and batting in one of those was...
And have you only actually got one?
You have only got one, because it's only the one side, yeah. Well, actually,
you didn't have a replacement one.
I have washed it. Like, I can wash it. I can stick it in a bath and, like, get the sweat out of it, but that's about it. And
just full of Febreze.
Yeah. It is well
nice
odoured.
Nice smelling to get out of it.
Was the whole sort of wear and tear on your body of the, you know, the various bodily movements that you had to, sorry, the upper body movements yeah, that you yeah. had to have, sorry, Piers, I'm sorry, what? Piers, sorry, upper body movements that you had, was it actually causing further damage to, you know, the muscles and the tendons and everything that, was it actually...
Making my body worse.
Was it making it worse?
I think having finished playing cricket now, yeah, it was.
Right.
Like, I've taken up swimming now and... my body is so much better compared to how I was. To wake up every day and not be stiff, not be sore. I do not miss that.
Is there certain strokes you can't do? Like, I mean, obviously, bearing in mind, if you're doing something like front crawl, you're still getting your arm
front crawl is probably the hardest. Front crawl is literally the hardest. Like, it's funny enough, breaststroke is actually one of my better strokes.
All right.
Yeah, it's but butterfly is a little bit harder, and backstroke again. So
we're talking doggy paddle here, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We're talking Lilos. Yes.
Lilos
and a cocktail.
And a paddleboard. But I forgot where we were.
We're swimming. The wear and tear on your
body. The wear and tear on my body was... It was definitely... Like any bowl, it's a tough job. Physically, it's a tough job. My back ended up going. Now, that was what ended my career. And it's hard to say whether that was because of my condition. It obviously wouldn't have helped. But if anyone had told a 15-year-old lad back then, you're going to have 6 years of professional cricket, I'd have bitten your arm off. Mm. And to be now training... I mean, I was swimming this morning. I had... Para GB come down and assess me this morning for swimming, and I'm on the waiting list to go and get classification for Paralympic swimming.
It's funny, because I was going to a question I was going to ask you, because obviously this is, we said at the top of the main show that this is a condition that a lot of Paralympians have, and when I was doing some research into this, quite a lot of them were actually swimmers. So that doesn't surprise me per se. So the question I was going to ask you: what Paralympic sport would you like to have a go at, or that you could actually do? I mean, obviously you couldn't do javelin, really.
Okay, this is the first time I've ever spoken about it. But I came at the end of my career. Someone came to me and said, "Lou, have you ever thought of going into Paralympic sport?" And funny enough, when I was training to be a professional cricketer, one of my old schoolmates, who was one of the other guys who came out of my school as a very good athlete, ended up being a Paralympic pilot rider for a blind in tandem cycling.
Oh wow!
And he just got silver medal at Rio. He's a good, from the same village as me. We grew up together.
Okay.
And we used to train together. And his bike coach at the time, because we used to spend a lot of time in the gym and on bikes, when we were training together, his gym coach said to me, "Would you ever think?" Going to the Paralympics, I pretty much told him to F off. Like, I was like, don't you dare think of me as a Paralympian. And that's how defensive I was back then. Mm. As a kid, that's how defensive I was. Having finished the sport, grown up, now out there talking about my condition and sort of the things I went through, not only physically but mentally. And I realised, like, I have an opportunity. It'd be pretty cool if I ended up being a Paralympian to have played professional, fully able-bodied sport. As a potential Paralympian, like, that's very, very rare.
I mean, do you think
swimming is what I want
to do?
So swimming is what you would actually be prepared to do within the Paralympics?
It's pretty much what I could only do. I've already been assessed in athletics and my legs are fine, I'm okay.
Oh, so, right.
Swimming is pretty much the one that I would be able to be classified in, and I'm borderline at the moment.
It's perverse, I mean. You're actually still relatively too, or for a lot of sports, you're too able bodied.
Yep. Right. Yeah, so.
But do you think that, I mean, with the Paralympics now, I mean, that they call it superhumans, and there's a lot of TV coverage, and it's become a massive, massive thing.
Yeah.
And people are generally looking at it a lot differently now. I mean, has that affected you and changed your attitude, perhaps?
Not necessarily. I think I've grown up a little bit as well. But, yeah, I think the access to it and realising that it is... I think it's so hard for me to... A lot of people ask me, like, what's it like having it? I don't know. Mm. But I actually was fortunate enough to go up to meet all the Paralympic swimmers that came back from Rio through mutual friends have managed to get in touch with the head coach of Para GB and went up there. And I was, so when I was around them, it was the first time I'd ever been in an environment and I kind of felt really myself and really massively felt like, not fitted in, but this is, I'm okay here. I don't have to hide anything. I don't have to hide anything. I really didn't have to hide anything. I didn't have to have my shirt. Going to a swimming pool, for me, used to be something that was really, really intimidating. Going to the beach, really intimidating, because I was self-conscious about how I looked. That was more as I grew up and became more aware of how I looked. But now, when I walked into that swimming pool, shirt off in my swimming kit, like, I didn't feel any different. And that was a sudden moment of, like, I could do this and feel totally fine. Otherwise, previously, like I said, I used to fight it and I used to fight people who would sort of belittle it and I wouldn't accept it. And it took time to
gradually. Do you feel that something like London 2012 has changed things at all? Or has it changed it for you, or do you think...
It's changed the sport. It's changed how people view people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopefully campaigning with a few people at the moment to change people's views on how people who look a little bit different are viewed in society. There's so much room to go, and there's so many things in the world that that will take a long time to get there. But I think the Paralympics are doing a great job.
Do you have a hankering to go to Tokyo then?
I'd love to, yeah.
Right.
Speaking to the guys today, I don't want to go into this. I don't want to swim at all, unless there is something, a chance of me winning something or getting to the very top.
Are your times there or thereabouts at the moment?
They're getting a lot better, yeah. So the guy who came to see me, he saw me 6 months ago, and he said, yeah, you're going all right.
Because it's amazing. I mean, you have to remember is that with swimmers, they generally start from a very, very young age, and they're doing it 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day, every day.
Again, you have to really take Paralympic sport as a completely different entity, in the fact that a lot of the Paralympians who compete in Team GB are ex-military, and those guys tend to have come out of the military only a few years before they compete, and it's kind of where I'm at, really.
Yeah. But then you've got someone like Ellie Simmons as well, who's also a swimmer, and she's just amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
It's amazing what these people can do, and what they all do.
But I mean, we also see an awful lot of similar sort of stuff going through Albion in the community. So have you done any stuff with them at all?
No, I'd love to do more stuff in the community. Again, I think at the end of the month I'm going to be coming out. I've got a website being launched, and a lot more. I'm going out now doing a lot more motivational speaking. There's so many things that I took from my story that I think are relative in all walks of life. So I go out and do a lot more speaking, schools, corporate, anything really. And that's where I want to focus myself alongside everything else I'm doing. But the community stuff, I'd love to be working with young people and inspiring them on to do whatever it is they want to do.
Well, I was about to say, what aspect of it? I mean, are we talking about sort of like, because not only is there, obviously, there's the various disability sports within our community, and admittedly mostly focused around football. There's power chair, there's amputee football, there's walking football, there's, there's blind football and so on. But in also doing stuff with Albion, the community, is Sussex doing something similar in terms of, I know there's blind cricket where play with a ball the size of a beach ball, isn't it? Is there sort of similar stuff that goes on at Sussex?
They have an annual disability day down at Sussex, which has grown year on year on year. They actually formed their charitable arm, the Cricket Foundation. The Sussex Cricket Foundation is formed sort of off the back of the success of AITC, and they want to emulate that. Obviously, Brighton have got such a stronghold in the community, with it being the biggest team in the area, and obviously it's a big area that Brighton encompasses. But they're doing a lot of things. I mean, I was only at the last fixture of the year, and they give out like free health checks to people in the community. You can just come in and get free health checks, blood tests. So there's loads of different things that they do, not only just for disability, but for actually everyone in the community. It's going to be, they're very early stages, but they'll be growing year on year.
Okay, well, we've got to talk about cricket itself and Sussex. Not the greatest season on the pitch, but I mean, in terms of the people that are actually coming through. I mean, the management will see it as a success because, I mean, it was part of a three-year plan, I believe.
Yeah, my last year was the first year of that three-year plan. Obviously gone very well for them, getting me having gone. But that was Mark Davis's plan, is this three-year growth plan for the young players.
I was going to say, I mean, what was his plan? Because my understanding, certainly Joffre Archer caught them somewhat unawares.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and he's probably going to be the star if they keep him long term.
Joffre was a bizarre one in the fact that he's been playing in Sussex for the last 3 years, really. And they saw him at the time that he was this wild card, had a little bit of a junior attitude on him, and this very very Bayesian,
very diplomatic,
yeah, very Bayesian attitude as well. Even what I'm saying, he's from Barbados and he has got a very Bayesian way of doing things. But you knew he had the skills. You knew he had the skills. His body was actually the one thing that they were really worried about because he'd had really bad back problems. So his body wasn't holding up, and he wasn't bowling the overs that he was meant to be. Come to last year. 2016 season, he suddenly, Chris Jordan got him under his wing and he became stronger, and he spent a lot of time with CJ and John Lewis, the bowling coach, and suddenly went through the roof and had that phenomenal breakthrough, and then this season just continued that growth, and it'll just keep going, I think, because it's so simple what he does and it's so good. A lot of the guys that are still in the team that I'm in contact with are going, how's Joffre getting on? They're going, this guy is one of the best.
He can bat as well, can't he?
That's the thing. Like, people underestimate that sometimes.
As a bowler, which is better, Archer or Garton? Because Garton is on the England radar already.
At the moment, Joffre's got him. I think George is going to be a very good bowler. He's just got that. His progression is just a little bit slower. That's all. Some people progress very quick.
I mean, the George Garton one's odd because he keeps getting picked for the Lions, but not for Sussex. And it's sort of the ECB is seeing something. But
yeah,
because we've got this barrage of fast bowlers, he's not getting into the team.
Yeah, Kevin Shine is the guy at England ECB who will be working with George, and they'll know how he's functioning. Yes, he may not be getting the games at Sussex, but that is genuinely because they've got such good bowlers at the moment. You may see something completely different next year in the fact that he's included a lot more.
I've got to ask you about Mason Crane, because that was one that got away.
Mark Robinson's
Mason,
great.
I played against Mason. He played for Worthing, and Mason was, you knew Mason was special when you played against him in club level. For a 15 year old kid as a leggy, that is really, really hard work. Like, it's the hardest skill in cricket as a bowler. And he was getting whacked all over the place. But he's one of these guys where he had... And you even listen to Shane Warne when he talks about leg spin bowling. Is you have to be brave and you have to have this air of confidence. And Mason had that. Like, he would get hit for six and get me the ball back. I'm going to go. I'm going to bowl googly. I'm going to do something different. And he would genuinely keep working harder and harder and harder. Yes, there were some things at Sussex, and Hampshire ended up getting him. And he's just gone strength for strength.
Was it his fielding they were worried about amongst other things?
I don't think his batting and his fielding were up to scratch at the time, but I don't really know. I wasn't really in those conversations.
I mean, should he be going to Australia?
I think he should.
I genuinely
think he should.
The problem is, if we're 4-0 down going into Sydney, chuck him in.
Play him.
And it believe it broke Kerrigan and it broke... Schofield.
Kerrigan was on the wrong other end of his career, though.
No, it wasn't. Kerrigan was 2021 when he played at the Oval.
But I think they've learned, and Trevor Bayliss is a very good coach, manager of people, and he's already been out there. He's played for New South Wales.
Yeah, I mean, he played
Australia.
State cricket last year.
So you've
year,
got
didn't
Australians who now know that he's the real deal. Like, for New South Wales to play him, like, I don't think people realise how New South Wales is like a closed shop to any.
Oh, really?
Outsider, especially an Englishman, because New South Wales has been the force of Australian cricket. They were the Yorkshire of England. A strong New South Wales means a strong Australia. That was always what they said, even when I was out there. And for an Englishman, let alone a teenage Englishman, to just jump into that team as a leg spinner, like, that's unheard of. There would have been people going up in arms, why is there not an Australian spinner being played? But he earned his right in. Yeah. He earned his way into that team.
And he did well, didn't he?
And he did well. And he did well. So they're not going to take him lightly. He can bowl. I think he's got the attitude. Knowing him, I think he's got
the
temperament
to do it. As well.
And he knows conditions. He's been out there and played. So good he's on the squad. I don't know if he'll play. If he does play, I'm going to be backing him all the way.
If he plays, the series has gone wrong, is the problem.
Yeah.
I know that's a defeatist attitude, but it will be the old thing if they lose. They're 3-0 down in Perth.
They're going to back Ali.
I was about to say, what if they're 4-0 up, they go to Sydney, then chucking him again? What I mean is then you're chucking him as well. Yep. So you say we might be 4-0 down, but if we're 4-0 up, you can chuck him in
great
as well.
Great time to learn. Great time to learn.
Yes, we can get on to the Ashes if you want, especially after today's news.
Which is today's news?
Well, they put Stephen Finn in and Stokes isn't travelling at the moment. If the police action's dropped, he'll go.
And just quickly before we finish, Brighton this season, where do you see us? How many games are you going to get to?
How many am I going to get to? Well, my brother's got our tickets wrapped up at the moment, and there are people. His phone is a hot ticket at the moment, and I want to get to as many as I can.
Now, your brother, that's Bradley Hatcher. He runs My Club,
and partners with the Albion to run the Network Albion Business Club. So I'll plug his business as little bit as
well
I can.
That's fine.
So if there are business people out there in the area who are looking to get involved either with the club or network their own business in the area. Look up Network Albion Business Club.
But Brad is going to come in here and he's going to undo all your good work, I think.
He will, yeah.
He'll certainly argue with all your stories about,
smashing me around the garden.
Yeah, tearing up your dad's lawn.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just tell him that you had his stumps cartwheeling every single day.
Yeah, exactly.
Into the greenhouse.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave it. Thank you very much to Lewis Hatchett. Thank you very much to Piers Benjamin. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back with a normal show next Saturday on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We'll see you then. Thanks a lot. Bye. It was a beautiful day, sun beat down. I heard the radio on. I was driving. Trees went by. Me and Del were singing. Anything was possible. Hit cruise control and rub my eyes. The last 3 days, the rain was unstoppable. It was always cold, no sunshine. Some time. There's something.